Lecture 19. Legion versus Phalanx. Six pitched battles.
In the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC, the Romans had to contend with the most formidable military formation of its day, the Macedonian phalanx, which we've already reviewed in lectures 15 and 16. In this lecture, we consider Polybius's comparison of the phalanx and the legion and test his assessment against six titanic clashes of the two formations. Polybius devotes a passage of his history to comparing the strengths and weaknesses of the Macedonian phalanx and the Roman legion, as they both existed in his day. The phalanx, he says, formed up 16 men deep, so that the points of the first five ranks extended out in front of the formation. The pikes of the rear 11 ranks were held upright to protect against missiles. As long as the phalanx maintained this tight formation, it was invincible. The legion, in contrast, adopted a looser formation. Whereas the phalangites occupied a 3-foot frontage, each legionary occupied 6, since he needed space to wield his sword. Therefore, says Polybius, each legionary would face 10 pike heads. The weakness of the phalanx, in Polybius's mind, lay in maintaining its ideal cohesion. He insists that it could only operate on flat ground, unbroken by any encumbrances such as gullies, woods, or streams. The legion, in contrast, could operate effectively in most landscapes. Whereas the phalanx required a total commitment of troops, he says, the Romans kept men in reserve. Whether pushing forward or being pushed back, the phalanx lost its cohesion, but the legion did not. Thus, the legionaries maintained their effectiveness as a battle proceeded, while the phalanx tended to lose it. Polybius also places great emphasis on the fighting qualities of the individual Roman legionary, who was effective in large or small units, or even individually, and was trained and equipped accordingly. But the phalangite was only effective in the company of the whole phalanx. Such are the bare bones of Polybius's analysis. Despite the fact that he wrote from personal experience of both formations, which lends his observations great authority, his conclusions have been justly criticized. First, they are overly schematic. The claim, for instance, that each legionary would encounter 10 pike points due to his occupying twice the frontage of the phalangite is really simplistic and mechanical. Such a mathematically rigid scenario was unlikely ever to occur in real-life battle conditions. Next, Polybius's contention that the phalanx was effective only on flat surfaces is demonstrably erroneous. Under Philip and under Alexander, it had operated successfully in the northern Balkans, in Thrace, Illyria, and mainland Greece, and even in the mountain fastnesses of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Phalanxes, as we've seen, had advanced across rivers and streams at the battles of Chaeronea, the Granicus, and Issus. Now, it may well be that the phalanx was optimally employed on a flat and plain surface, but that is not Polybius's argument. Finally, it is not the case that the phalanx required the simultaneous commitment of all units. At Chaeronea, the phalanx was deployed in an oblique angle and engaged the enemy in sections. So this contention of Polybius is also erroneous and overly schematic. These details aside, Polybius's broad contention is that the legion was more flexible than the phalanx. This claim can be tested by looking at actual engagements. The great clashes of the legion and the phalanx in the 2nd century BC tend to overshadow the fact that the two systems first encountered each other on the soil of Italy in the early 3rd. We must therefore backtrack chronologically a little to survey these battles fought against Pyrrhus, king of Epirus. In 280 BC, Pyrrhus invaded Italy from his kingdom on the Adriatic coast, bringing with him a fully integrated, up-to-date Hellenistic army of a type more formidable than anything the Romans had faced up to that point. Unfortunately, Pyrrhus's 3 battles with the Romans are not well documented. Livy exists only in a form of summary called an epitome for these years, so we rely mostly on Plutarch's Life of Pyrrhus, written 400 years after the fact, as well as scraps in other sources. Now, given the uncertainties and contradictions already noted in better documented ancient battle narratives, this means we're not in good shape, source-wise. At the time of the invasion of Pyrrhus, the Romans had relatively recently gone over to the manipular tactical system, perhaps only 40 years earlier. It was now put to a brutal test by Pyrrhus's trained and professional 20,000 phalangites, 3,000 cavalry, 2,000 archers, 500 slingers, and 20 war elephants. Who would prevail? A consular army, presumably 20,000 men strong, was sent against Pyrrhus straight away. The story goes that Pyrrhus was curious and rode out to observe the Roman camp and commented that he saw nothing barbarous in these barbarians' dispositions. A clash took place at the site of Heraclea in South Italy in 280 BC. Our fullest source is Plutarch's biography of Pyrrhus, which naturally focuses on the king's actions and offers anecdotes that reflect on his character. Of broader tactical insight, there is none. But the main events appear to have been as follows. The Romans charged Pyrrhus across a river. The Epirot cavalry blocked them while the phalanx formed up behind and then charged. Interestingly, the legionaries withstood this assault, a sure sign of their high morale and fighting stamina. Plutarch comments that, quote, there were seven turns of fortune as each side fled back or pursued, whatever that means. Pyrrhus then sent in his elephants, which threw the Romans into confusion and allowed the Epirot cavalry to secure victory. While the other sources are even sketchier than this, the consensus seems to be that the elephants were key to Pyrrhus's victory at the Battle of Heraclea. It seems likely that the phalanx did its usual job of holding the enemy in place, while mobile units, in this case the elephants backed by the cavalry, hammered the victory home, probably from the flanks. The casualties are variously given. One source has 4,000 Epirots and 7,000 Romans lost. If this is correct, this represents 16,000 of Pyrrhus's invading army, although Greek and Samnite defectors from the locality soon compensated these losses. It may have been after this battle that Pyrrhus made his most famous remark. As a general congratulated him on victory, the king commented, "Another victory like that, and we're done for." We are also told that Pyrrhus, examining the Roman dead, noted that they all lay facing the enemy and mused wistfully, "I would already rule the whole inhabited world were I king of the Romans." On Pyrrhus's own admission, then, the legions had performed admirably against the more professional Hellenistic army at the Battle of Heraclea. But when all is said and done, the scoreboard has to read Phalanx 1, Legion 0. The next battle, fought at Asculum in 279 BC, is so badly attested that our sources do not agree on who commanded the Romans, how long the battle lasted, one day or two, or what the result was, a victory for Pyrrhus, a victory for the Romans, or a draw. So there's little point in dwelling on this clash, save for one detail. The Romans had clearly been thinking about what to do with the elephants, which they had not encountered before the Battle of Heraclea. So they brought to Asculum anti-elephant wagons, wagons with blades and spikes projecting out of them and carrying archers and other missile troops. But we hear the Roman general, rather stupidly, stationed these strange contraptions at one end of his line. So Pyrrhus simply put the elephants at the other end and bypassed the wagons entirely. Pyrrhus's light-armed troops then dealt easily with the wagons. Plutarch, ostensibly quoting Pyrrhus's own account of the engagement, says 6,000 Romans fell to Pyrrhus's 3,505. If so, Asculum was another Pyrrhic victory in both senses of the word. But given the defective sources, we ought to let the scoreboard stand at 1-0 to the phalanx and declare Asculum a draw or at best a marginal victory to Pyrrhus. Having driven the Romans off, Pyrrhus was given the cold shoulder by his local Greek allies in South Italy, so he went to Sicily and campaigned there for 4 years. But Roman encroachments soon goaded the South Italian Greeks to invite Pyrrhus back to the mainland, where another battle was fought against the Romans at Beneventum in 275 BC. The source problems that plagued the other Pyrrhic battles also plagued Beneventum. Plutarch is at his briefest and vaguest. The Romans, it seems, were successful in the main engagement. The elephants routed the Romans in one sector of the field and chased them all the way back to their camp, and there, either tormented by hails of javelins from the camp's garrison or following a mother looking frantically for her cub, they turned back, rampaged through Pyrrhus's ranks, and broke his army. As important as these Pyrrhic battles are, they remain maddeningly opaque in the crucial matter of how the legions handle the phalanx. Instead, the novelty of war elephants blinds our sources to the details of that clash. Polybius comments that Pyrrhus alternated Italian maniples and phalanx units down his line, suggesting that the pure Macedonian formation was somehow diluted. Even if correct, however, this detail cannot apply to Heraclea, which our sources agree was fought before any local allies joined Pyrrhus. Heraclea, at least, then, seems to have been a genuine clash of phalanx and legion, even if the elephants were the decisive arm. A 3rd century BC Italian plate, now in Rome, depicts a war elephant with her cub. Clearly, these creatures had made an impression on the Italian mind, and one can't help but wondering if the club may be a reference to the rampaging mother at Beneventum, although that is probably a bit of a stretch. As we approach the next great clashes of phalanx and legion that took place in the 2nd century BC, our scoreboard reads Phalanx 1, Legion 1. Our next battle took place at Cynocephali in Thessaly in 197 BC. The fullest accounts are in Polybius and Livy, with the latter clearly drawing on the former as a source. In 197 BC, the Roman Republic and King Philip V of Macedon had been at war for 4 years. There had been much maneuvering in the mountains of northern Greece, but no major engagement. The Roman consul in command in 197 was the young firebrand Titus Quinctius Flamininus, who was now skirting Philip in the mountains of Thessaly. Each side received reports of the other's whereabouts and advanced in that direction. On a foggy morning in April or May, the two armies were marching on either side of a ridge called Cynocephali, which means dog's head, ignorant of the other's proximity. Each army was about 25,000 men strong. Philip's included a 16,000-man phalanx with peltasts, mercenaries, skirmishers, and 2,000 cavalry making up the rest. The Romans may have had an additional 5,000 to 7,000 men, our sources are unclear in this detail, and they also had the support of 600 top-notch Aetolian cavalry and other light arm contingents, and some elephants. The scouts from each army unexpectedly happened on each other on the top of the ridge that separated the two forces and started fighting, and sent word that the enemy was at hand. From this initial skirmish, Cynocephali evolved piecemeal as the clash on the ridge escalated. Philip realized the peril of the situation and sent mercenary reinforcements who drove the Romans off the crest and down the other side. Flamininus, in response, drew up his entire army on his side of the ridge at the foot of the ridge. Philip, informed that the Romans were in flight, when in fact only the vanguard had been routed, decided to commit his entire force in the expectation that a decisive blow now might win the whole war. Although Philip's army was not yet fully assembled, he managed to bring up a portion of his phalanx, perhaps 5,000 to 6,000 men, reinforced by 2,000 peltasts and skirmishers. These formed up, lowered their pikes, and rolled down the hill at the Roman left wing, drawn up at the base. At this point, Livy displays his spectacular weaknesses as a military historian. He claims that Philip ordered his phalangites to lay down their pikes and engage the Romans with swords. But Polybius, who is at this point Livy's source, remember, actually reports that the order was to lower pikes into attack position. Now, that Livy could envision a Macedonian phalanx voluntarily laying aside its primary weapon and engaging with swords shows a staggering and very worrying ignorance of basic military matters. We are reminded of the constant need for caution when reading his battle narratives. Back to the battle. Philip had shortened and deepened his phalanx, making its downhill rush all the more effective. It forced the Roman left back. But Philip's advantage was only illusory. Only his right was engaged. The center of his army was arriving in dribs and drabs at the top of the ridgetop, where it stood watching the action, cheering but not participating. And Philip's left was still very much in transit, much of it far behind and very far from the ridge crest. Flamininus, seeing an opportunity, had his unengaged right wing charge the units on the ridge crest before they were drawn up. Led by elephants, the Romans drove the Macedonian center before them, reached the summit, and found elements of Philip's left still ascending the other side. At this point, a crucial decision was made. An unnamed tribune from the victorious Roman right peeled off 20 maniples, that would be about 2,400 men, wheeled them to his left, and charged back down the ridge, falling on the rear of the heretofore victorious Macedonian right. In an instant, the tables were turned. The Macedonians were sandwiched between two Roman lines. They broke and fled. Philip's army was now in a chaotic state. The Macedonian left, which had not taken part in the fight, saw that the Romans had won and held up their spears in surrender. But some forward Roman units plowed into them anyway and killed most of them. Whether this was an honest mistake, an example of Roman ruthlessness, or a lack of discipline remains debatable, but it adds a tragic epilogue to the battle. Polybius, followed by Livy, reports 8,000 Macedonians killed and 5,000 captured. The Romans lost 700, undoubtedly among those engaged by Philip's right. To be sure, this battle is an unusual one, but its very uniqueness illustrates all the more clearly the advantages of the Roman manipular system. Neither commander had expected a battle, and the Romans were at a topographical disadvantage as the fighting broke out. Yet, The manipular system allowed sections of Flamininus's army to operate independently, such as when his right attacked the Macedonian center, even as his own left was being hard-pressed by Philip's phalanx. More importantly, the quick thinking of a relatively junior officer assured victory. A tribune could draw 20 maniples out of the advancing battle line, wheel them about, and redirect them, apparently without too much difficulty. It is important to realize that all this was done in the heat of the battle itself. Such a maneuver would have been very difficult, if not unthinkable, for a phalanx in the midst of an engagement. That the Roman left did not break and flee, despite receiving the harrowing downhill charge of the Macedonian phalanx, is a feature of the battle that rarely gets attention. It was under immense pressure, forced to retreat, but it maintained good order and kept the Macedonian right occupied, while Flamininus and the tribune set up the conditions that led to victory. All of this speaks to the iron discipline and high fighting spirit of the Roman infantrymen. The overwhelming lesson of cynocephali is the adaptability and flexibility of the legion, very much as Polybius argues. Flamininus and the tribune could adapt their tactics to new conditions as they arose, and the manipular system gave them the tool to realize their plans. Phalanx 1, Legion 2. The next major clash of the legion and phalanx took place in 190 BC at a place called Magnesia near Sipolis in Asia Minor. But the battle is poorly documented and the phalanx legion element in it remains obscure, so we will treat it rather briefly. Rome's opponent was King Antiochus III of Syria, who had rashly answered Greek calls for liberation in 192 BC. Soundly defeated in the Balkans, he now found himself facing the Romans on his home turf, the first time a Roman army had crossed into Asia. Antiochus presided over the Seleucid monarchy, a cultural descendant of both the ancient Near East and of Alexander's Macedon. His army was therefore an Asian-Macedonian hybrid, varied in both equipment and mode of combat. In the center was a phalanx of 16,000 men drawn up 32 deep, twice the norm. The rest of Antiochus's army was comprised of elephants, scythed chariots, camel units, cataphracts, mounted archers, and skirmishers armed with slings, javelins, and bows. A 10,000-strong royal bodyguard called the Silver Shields was drawn up in a phalanx to the right of the main phalanx. This formidable force is usually numbered at around 72,000, of which 12,000 were cavalry. A recent modern estimate, however, goes for a much lower total of around 45,000. Antiochus had chosen terrain perfect for the phalanx and for his cavalry, flat and lacking in obstructions. Our sources insist Antiochus split his phalanx into 10 units and stationed 54 war elephants in the intervals, an arrangement that is wholly incomprehensible. The strength of the phalanx resided in its density and cohesion. Breaking it up into smaller units would only weaken it. And while war elephants were certainly effective, they were notoriously unruly. The most likely outcome of embedding elephants into a phalanx was a lot of trampled phalangites. The elephants, rather, were probably stationed together in the line in front of the phalanx. The Romans were commanded by Lucius Cornelius Scipio, the brother of the great Scipio Africanus, who was also present but played no part in events due to illness. Scipio drew up his infantry and stationed his cavalry 3,000 strong on the right flank. Among these was King Eumenes, ruler of an allied kingdom of Pergamum in northwest Asia Minor. The infantry's left flank was protected by a river and 120 cavalry. Scipio also had 16 African elephants held in reserve behind the Triarii. In all, the sources number the Romans at around 30,000, including the Pergamene contingent. But some think that far too small for a Roman army sent to take on a king as powerful as King Antiochus. So modern estimates tend to upgrade Roman strength to the region of 50,000. The fighting started with the Roman skirmishers confronting the scythed chariots. These vehicles were especially fearsome to the infantry, and so neutralizing them at the outset was a priority. The Roman skirmishers under Eumenes succeeded in driving the chariots away in complete confusion. The rout of the chariots induced a general rout in the Seleucid left, which in turn threw the phalanx of Antiochus into some confusion. The legions took this opportunity to attack, but struggled hard with the disciplined phalanx, which may have formed a defensive square, as is described in one source. But the ancient descriptions of this clash, so crucial to our interest here, are confused and largely useless. Meanwhile, Antiochus's heavy cavalry bypassed the river and assailed the weak Roman left. The nearby infantry now flanked, panicked, and ran back toward their camp. As the Seleucid cavalry bore down, a tribune left in charge of the camp rallied his garrison and the fleeing infantry and put up stiff resistance. At this juncture, Eumenes and the victorious Pergamene cavalry saw this growing crisis and charged across the field to assist. Their arrival drove off the Seleucid horse. The hard fighting in the center was now winding down, and when the elephants in this zone went on the rampage through the phalanx, all was lost for Antiochus. His army broke and ran. Appian and Livy number 50,000 killed on the Seleucid side, compared to a mere 300 Romans and only 25 Pergamenes. Clearly, Antiochus's losses are far too large. That would be 70% casualty rate if his army was as strong as 72,000. But we have no way to correct the figures. Magnesia was determined by cavalry action, and the details of the infantry engagement are lost. In this sense, then, it is not a particularly useful battle for our current purposes, even if, in terms of Roman history, it was a monumental achievement, the defeat of a superpower on its home turf. Our final battle brings us back to Greece. Philip V had been neutralized by the Second Macedonian War, but his kingdom continued to be eyed with some suspicion by the Romans. When Philip's son and successor, Perseus, came to the throne in 179 BC, he began strengthening Macedon's hand in the Aegean Sea. Allies of Rome in the region appealed for intervention, and the Third Macedonian War broke out in 171. The war dragged on indecisively for 4 years until the arrival in 168 of Lucius Aemilius Paulus, a dynamic and aggressive commander whose father and namesake had perished as consul at Cannae. Paulus had command experience already and now advanced aggressively against Perseus, finally bringing him to battle on the plain before the coastal town of Pydna in the shadow of Mount Olympus in Thessaly. The future of Macedon as a kingdom was at stake. The sources for this battle, while better than for Magnesia, are flawed. Polybius' account, almost certainly gleaned from the testimony of contemporaries who had actually taken part in the fight, is lost. But it probably informs Livy's surviving report. That's the good news. The bad news is that Livy's manuscript is missing two pages at this point, leaving a large hole in the middle of his account of Pydna. So Plutarch's sketchier Life of Aemilius Paulus is our only continuous source. At Pydna, Perseus had 40,000 infantry, both Macedonians and mercenaries, of which perhaps 20,000 were in the phalanx, including elite units such as the Bronze Shields, the White Shields, and the Royal Guard, the Agema, who numbered 3,000. He also had 4,000 cavalry under his personal command. Paulus had a regular consular army of 2 legions and the similar number of allies, numbering perhaps 20,000 heavy infantry, but he also had Greek allies, cavalry, and some elephants. And it's here that we feel the loss of Polybius and the 2 pages of Livy, who would undoubtedly have clarified the details for us. Perseus had the numeric advantage, but estimating its extent is impossible. As with the numbers, the battle order on each side is also indistinct, but we may assume that the phalanx occupied Perseus' center, flanked by mercenary and allied troops, with cavalry and light-armed on the wings. We are told by another source that the phalanx was doubled in depth to 32 men. Plutarch paints an impressive picture of this army, backlit with armor and pike points glittering in the sun. The Roman army was probably drawn up in regular order, legions in the middle, allies on the wings, and all in 3 lines, with the cavalry on the flanks. One piece of information offers some precision amidst all this vagueness. The night before the battle, there was a lunar eclipse, which dates the Battle of Pydna to the 22nd of June, 168 BC. The battleground was a coastal plain, and so nominally to the advantage of the phalanx. But it had 2 small rivers running through it, and towards the west end, where the Romans were, the ground became uneven. These topographical features were to play a critical role in the fighting. The battle started late in the day, since Paulus was facing southeast and did not want the sun in his troops' eyes. Opposing foraging teams clashed across one of the 2 streams that was on the plain in between the armies, and rather like cynocephali, this skirmish evolved into a full-scale engagement. Unlike cynocephali, both sides were deployed in full formation and waiting for a fight. The phalanx advanced so quickly that Paulus did not reach the battlefield from his tent in his camp before they were engaged. Here he saw the awesome power of the Macedonian phalanx in action. Later in life, he admitted to being appalled at the sight, the onset of tens of thousands of pikes, some of his men skewered, others with the points of the pikes embedded into their large shields trying to wrest themselves free, some slashing at the points with their swords, others grabbing at them with their bare hands. At the time, however, Paulus concealed his emotions for the sake of his troops' morale. The Roman line was pushed back, struggling. I find unconvincing the suggestion by one scholar that the legions had actually pulled out of the battle and were sitting up on higher ground watching out of fear, abandoning the light-armed and the Roman allies to face the phalanx alone. This idea has no real ancient attestation, and it is hard to see how light-armed troops could possibly withstand the onset of a double-depth phalanx. So we must imagine the legionaries receiving that charge, hard-pressed and retreating but not breaking. Now, in the terrible irony of the sort that litters military history, the very Macedonian success proved their undoing. The two lines were physically coupled by the sarissa points embedded in the Roman shields. No line of men, let alone one a mile long, can advance or retreat at a perfectly uniform pace. Some sections of the Roman line yielded more readily, some sections resisted more stubbornly. So as the phalanx advanced, it began to come undone. Gaps appeared, and as the phalanx entered the western end of the plain, the uneven ground accentuated these gaps. Seeing this, Paulus issued a brilliant order. Let the centurions take their maniples into the gaps as circumstances allowed. The Romans infiltrated the Macedonian ranks, laying about them on all sides with their terrible Spanish swords. The phalangites, both hands on their pikes and packed in close, tight formation, were practically helpless. As butchery widened the gaps, yet more Romans poured in, hacking right through the phalanx in some parts, coming into the rear, turning and then attacking the Macedonians from the back. The phalanx could not long sustain this sort of carnage, and it broke. Fleeing Macedonians reached the shore and swam out to boats, only to be cut down ruthlessly by the crews, who were Roman allies. Some of the swimmers then turned back to the shore, but there met an even more terrible end at the fate of Paulus's waiting elephants. No decisive role is ascribed to the cavalry or the elephants in this engagement, who were stationed somewhere on the Roman right. It appears to have been a pure legion phalanx contest, even more so than at Cynocephali, and the whole thing was over in less than an hour, though the slaughter of the fleeing went on until nightfall. Somewhere between 20 and 25,000 Macedonians perished at Pydna. The Romans lost 100, or, if we believe some sources, only 80. These figures rank Pydna with Marathon as one of the most imbalanced victories in recorded history. Paulus erected a monument at Delphi to commemorate his victory. The surviving reliefs show the battle, but they do so rather in an idealized form rather than in a realistic one. So the so-called Paulus Monument contributes very little to our understanding of what happened at Pydna. Perseus fled to the Greek islands, but was soon cornered and surrendered. The kingdom of Macedon, which had spawned Philip and Alexander not two centuries earlier, was dissolved into four puppet republics answerable to Rome. Having surveyed these battles, we can now see that Polybius's analysis of the phalanx's strengths and weaknesses, while certainly overstated and maybe a little simplistic, is largely borne out by the facts. The manipular legion was a more flexible military tool than the phalanx, and it allowed greater adaptability in the face of evolving battlefield conditions. The legion was a massed combat formation that could be subdivided into smaller units without losing cohesion or effectiveness. The Macedonian phalanx was a massed combat formation weakened if subdivided. Ancient sources other than Polybius emphasize that the phalanx's strength derived from its mass. It follows that fragmentation of that mass dissipated its strength. The battles that we've examined here bear this analysis out. A counter theory holds that the legions themselves routinely fought as a continuous phalanx. Accepting this entails that phalanx-legion battles were actually phalanx-phalanx battles, so there can have been no tactical advantage in the manipular deployment. All the Roman victories over the Macedonian phalanx were close-run affairs, goes this line of argument, and the fact that the Romans won can be ascribed to luck. I find this argument singularly unconvincing. Of the five battles reviewed above, and I omit Asculum, the Romans won four, three of those in a crushing fashion. The legions encountered the phalanx on terrain as divergent as the ridges of northern Greece, the plains of western Turkey, or the plains and slopes of Pydna. No legion was broken by the phalanx in any of these encounters, even at the Battle of Heraclea, where the elephants were decisive. Rather, these fights show that the legions could adapt to new battlefield situations as the fighting raged, and that tactical subunits allowed such adaptation to be effective. The classic examples are the 20 detached maniples at Cynocephali and Paulus exploiting the gaps at Pydna. There was far more to it than luck. In closing, I must reiterate here the crucial point that ended the last lecture. The fighting qualities and psychological stamina of the legionary were as critical, if not more so, than the tactical flexibility of the units he served in. He was well equipped, well motivated, tough, and extremely well led by his centurions. Any army with such qualities will stay longer, cohere better, and endure more punishment to see a fight through without breaking. The Romans had no exclusive claim to courage on the ancient Mediterranean battlefield, but they appeared to have harnessed its underpinnings like none before them.